This is recorded on the afternoon of June 21st, 1972, in the offices of Professor M. G. Mellon, of the retired, of the Department of Chemistry at Purdue University. This recording is made in interview with Professor Eccles of the Department of History and is to be for use for all accredited persons and purposes of the Purdue University Archives. Well, Professor Mellon, I suppose the best thing to start is at the beginning. Would you tell us about your family background and your elementary school and your high school education, your college education?
I was born in northwestern Pennsylvania, Crawford County, near the village of Conneaut Lake, October 25th, 1893. I went to a one-room country school, an eighth grader, for my grade school education, walking about three-quarters of a mile each day. By a little extra study, I was able to miss the third grade, so the eighth grades were done in 7 years. Then it was decided that I should go to Conneaut Lake High School, 5 miles away from the farm. They had dirt roads at that time. I drove the 5 miles to and from the school each day.
You drove in a car or did you hitch a horse?
I got the horse in the barn, got up in the morning, got it fed, curried, harnessed, drove the 5 miles. Put the horse in a little barn in the village, went at noon and fed it its oats. And incidentally, school never started any time here until 9 o'clock in the morning. And we were in school until 4 in the afternoon. I don't understand why the modern youngsters have to be out at 2:30 or a quarter of 3 in order to get home in time for supper.
Because the bus may break down.
That might be. I took an examination in another neighboring town school and passed the ninth grade examination there, so we persuaded the principal to let me start the 10th grade rather than the ninth in order to do high school in 3 years. And that was a rough year because I had no Latin and no algebra, so I took the first year's course in Latin, mathematics, and so on, but listened in on the next year's class. About the middle of the year, I was shifted into the second year's courses and finally made through the 10th grade then in that first year. So that was a memorable year. The 11th and 12th grades then were finished in regular fashion.
Now this is the same high school?
Same high school.
Did you do anything in high school, like debating or playing the basketball team? Or?
Well, this high school was so small, I envy the modern high school youngster with really this magnificent equipment, facilities, and then wonder why they arrive in Purdue University unable to read, write, or multiply 2 by 2 and get 4, when the high school which I attended had a total of 55 students. The staff consisted of the principal and his wife. So obviously we didn't have any baseball team or varsity football team, so on. There were no athletics, couldn't have. We did have a little literary society, and this operated about each 2 weeks. And each time, two or three of the youngsters were asked to give an impromptu talk. They were not given the subject until they stood up before the high school. I shall never forget the day of my first impromptu assignment, when I was assigned the subject of hunting, and it was one thing I liked to do at that time, it was to hunt. Every Saturday was devoted to hunting something, if anything could be found. Standing before this group of 50 students, assigned the subject of hunting, I was unable to speak. I could not say a word. In despair, I went to my seat and sat down. Well, at any rate, there were 10 of us in the senior class, no, in my class when I started. By the time we reached the senior year, there were 2 of us left, the doctor's daughter and myself. She died some 35 years ago, so I am the class of 1910 at Conneaut Lake High School, Pennsylvania. I have a class reunion any time it strikes me.
You go back, have you ever gone back, visited the old high school in places, or do you have family there still?
Well, until very recently, my father and mother still lived there, so I was back every year, practically, in the village. I've not been back two or three years, because just 3 years ago, my father died at 98, and that ended the family, so I have not been back since that time.
Your father was a farmer?
Yes.
And you were, in essence, you were a farmer?
I was raised on a farmer, as a farmer, yes.
Did you have any science when you were in high school?
I was supposed to have a chemistry course. There was no laboratory. About 2 weeks before the end of the last semester, $50 worth of chemicals arrived, the first to reach the high school. So my girl classmate and I played around with a few things, with a few test tubes in the 8 or 9 days that remained, and that was my high school chemistry. The professor had been a Latin major in college, and he knew, I would say now, no chemistry. He did the best he could with the textbook available. As I look back on it, I really had no chemistry. And the physics was even worse, because the wife of the principal had the physics course, and she couldn't work a single problem. Each night that any problems came up, she took the book home and asked her husband to try to work those. In the next class, she appeared with the solution, which he had worked out the night before. My science was pretty thin, as I look back on it now.
Good heavens. And yet you became a scientist. How did this occur?
My uncle, my mother's older brother, had been a student at Allegheny College, but he was so poor that he couldn't manage to finish, and he was a teacher, a grade school principal. One summer, the summer before I was to go to college, he took me to Allegheny College and introduced me to the president, who had been president when the uncle was in school a brief time that he was there. The president looked at me and said, "Young man, you want to take biology as a major in science, don't you?" I said, "Yes, sir." So the day of registration came, and I showed up at the registrar's office window to register. And the registrar, who was the professor of French, took a look at me. He said, "Young man, you want chemistry for your science, don't you?" I said, "Yes, sir." So he put down in chemistry. That was the start of my chemical career.
From such beginnings.
Yeah.
Well, what did you do at Allegheny? Did you spend the 4 years there?
Well, I started in with chemistry in 1910, and this was a revelation. The head of the chemistry department was a very remarkable man. He undoubtedly took me into chemistry. He'd been trained as a journalist, and he had a command of the English. Why he changed to chemistry, I do not know. He changed to chemistry, and he had a command of English before his classes that I have seldom heard equaled in all the years since. And really, it was his inspiration, talking about chemistry and so on, that persuaded me, not that year to be a chemistry student, but I was thinking seriously about that. So I dropped out, trying to decide what to do, and finally received an appointment to teach one of these 8th grade one-room schools, some 3.5 miles from my farm home. I was delighted to get this appointment at $40 a month. The school year was 7 months, so the total in sight was $280. Well, I drove 2.5 miles. By this time, my younger brother was ready to go to high school, so we started off together. We drove as far as the railroad. I walked about 1.25 miles down the Erie Railroad to the little school close to the railroad. In the evening, came back up the tracks, hoping my brother would be on the way home from high school. If not, I stood by the tracks and waited on him. Well, during that second year, there was no question by the end of the year what I wanted to do, namely go back to college and major in chemistry. So the second year, I started then seriously into the chemistry major curriculum at Allegheny.
You finished in, as of what year?
Well, I started in 1910. I should have been a 1914 graduate, but dropping out the year, I was then a member of the 15 class. And since that time, I've been glad I did that, if for no other reason than if that was the centennial class at Allegheny. It was founded in 1815, so I was a 1915 graduate. And the centennial class, as the years have passed, I think has had a certain interest and loyalty to the institution that none of the others seem to show.
Wasn't that E.C. Young's college? Didn't he go to Allegheny?
He went to Grove City.
Grove City, I do beg your pardon.
Down the way, about 40 miles. Yes.
I don't know why I thought Allegheny. All right. Anyone else in the faculty and alumnus of Allegheny, too?
Of the family?
Of you. Of the faculty, of your friends and acquaintances.
Well, my brother, of course, was a 16 graduate. He finished up the next year. He picked up a year on me because he didn't drop out a year as I had done. Those are the only relatives.
Was your chemistry course a course designed to send you on to graduate school, or was it a course in classical chemistry? Was it one of those that was designed to send you out just with the knowledge of chemistry?
Well, it's a little difficult today. I suppose with that background, I'd have difficulty getting into the modern graduate school because of the great advances, especially in physical chemistry and mathematics, that we now expect our graduates coming into Purdue to know. I didn't know today. And I look back on, I had 9 or 10 courses in chemistry and had some things that these youngsters coming in here now do not have. They knew much more, of course, in some things than I did. There again, I was, in essence, cut short because our laboratory in organic chemistry lasted about 2 weeks total in Allegheny College. The head of the department didn't like organic chemistry very well, and he didn't provide much organic chemistry laboratory work. Now, the classwork under a young fellow from New Hampshire was reasonably good. The laboratory was very poor, and I suffered from that as soon as I got into graduate school.
When did you make up your mind to go to graduate school, and how? Did the war intervene, or were you in there when the war started?
Well, yes, I was a senior. When the war broke out in Europe, see, I was a senior at 14 and 15, so by the time I was getting out of Allegheny, well, it hadn't affected us seriously yet. We knew there was war going on, and that was about it. I didn't think much about that. Well, originally, I intended to go into industry and be some kind of a laboratory technician, as I look on it now.
By the way, did you work your way through college in the summers? Did you go home in the summers? Did you work?
Well, I was home working on the farm every summer.
All right.
Well, by the end of 1915, my senior year, I decided rather definitely not to go into industry, but to go to graduate school. I do not recall now, probably this head of the department talked me into that. At any rate, there was no question about it. He obtained an appointment for me at New York University and at Ohio State University, so I had to make a choice between going to the great city or going to the big country town of Columbus, Ohio. I chose to come west and not go east, for which I've had no regrets as the years have passed, incidentally.
Columbus is a pleasant town. Did you go to Columbus for your graduate school?
Yes, at Ohio State.
Did you live close to the campus down in the old part of town?
Well, not down around the old medical school. I lived right just across the street from the campus on the south side, West 11th
Street. On High Street?
Well, just west, or just west. South of the south. Campus, on West 11th. Oh, about 2 blocks from High Street.
Yeah. Anything remarkable or interesting about Columbus at those days?
Oh, it's
about Ohio State.
There's an overgrown country town, I suppose. Various students and I would walk down some 2 miles. We usually, partially because we couldn't afford streetcar fare, we walked down and whatever happened to interest us, going down, not often, but we did go down occasionally. This is just a big overgrown town. I was impressed by the architecture of the old Capitol. I still am.
It is an interesting building, isn't
yes.
It? It is most interesting. Well, how long were you at Ohio State?
Well, I went there in the fall of 1915. Of course, then more and more of the war began to get into the news. I was a teaching assistant, an assistant in freshman chemistry, and in that first year I had what it has turned out to be my best known chemistry student of all time, I assume. I told her so when I saw her again 2 years ago at the 50th class reunion, namely Mrs. Senator Bricker. She was in my laboratory to have as one of those to supervise. Well, she became the, in fact, she lived next door to where I roomed, and young Bricker came to see her, and I saw him come and go, of course.
He was a theological student, wasn't he, at that time?
He was in the law school.
Well, he's an ordained Methodist minister.
Bricker?
Yes.
Oh, is he?
Oh, yes.
No, I didn't
know.
That's
why I just wondered. No. He was in the law school at that time.
Yeah, he was in the law school. Well, at any rate, I was a teaching assistant at $30 per month for 10 months. I lived in a place, I roomed in a private home, but I ate in what's known as a boarding club there. There were half a dozen of them. We seem never to have had such a thing in Purdue, to my knowledge. About 50 of us were in this boarding club, 5 tables of 10 each. And part of my education came along in the broadening of my education occurred that year, because there were only 4 or 5 of us graduate students in this group, and the tables were reseated every week. So I was likely to be sitting between a veterinary student and a law student 1 week, and the next week between 2 other quite different people, and just keeping my mouth shut and listening to the conversation, I learned a good deal that year. I have been thankful for that experience, as a matter of fact.
Well, how long did it take you?
Well, it should have taken me 3 years. I finished up my master's degree work in the summer of 1916. Then I started out to major in organic chemistry for no particular reason, because that was the thing I was weakest in when I left Allegheny College. But by the end of the second year, well, I was assisting in the organic courses the second year, and went downtown one semester in charge of the organic chemistry laboratory for the old medical school. They still had their pre-medical laboratory work downtown, and I was sent down there to supervise the medical students, the pre-medical students. Well, I didn't fare well in the laboratory, partly because of this lack of training in Allegheny College, and by the end of that second year, I decided I just was not making progress with the other organic majors. And furthermore, I didn't like the general messiness of the place. Once in a while, the head of the department would storm in and order them to clean up and says, "You're a bunch of smear chemicals." So we'd clean up. About a month later, he'd appear and ordered cleaned up once more. So I was developing some aversion to the general messiness of many organic laboratories. I changed over to major then in physical chemistry at the end of the second year. Of course, changed major professors at that time. Well, that cost me then some time. And so actually I was, well then the, I went through the third year, the war coming on, of course, more and more, and the Chemical Warfare Service had been developing, and many of the college professors had gone into chemical warfare work, including quite a number of the Ohio State faculty. And I thought I was going to be drafted. I was registered. As it turned out, I was the only one of the graduate students in chemistry not drafted out of Ohio State University. And the only reason I have ever known, I saw the Ohio State paper one evening, and those exempted M.G. Mellon. And the only reason to this day I know could have accounted for that was that the year before I had been turned down flatly by the Union Central Life Insurance Company for insurance. As having,
you didn't think you might last long?
Well, they thought I had a bad heart. This was about the spring of 1917 that I got blacklisted. And I learned a lesson then, because it took me 10 years, at least, to get even a rated up policy.
Well, at least you didn't go. What did you do when you got out?
Well, as a result of all these graduate students having been drafted, many of them were sent back in uniform, but to work on gas warfare work. It was quite a center for gas warfare work, gas masks and so on, at Ohio State University. In fact, for a time, that's about all that went on in the graduate programs, research work. So by the time of my fourth year, there were so few assistants that I was given a full-time instructorship and was on full-time as an instructor, with the result that my coursework had been completed. But I was in charge of all sorts of laboratories, and I just didn't have time to carry on my own doctoral research program, except what I could do at night. And I went back night after night to do that in order to get through. Well, that cost me time again, so it was 4 years by the time I got through graduate school. 1919 I finished up.
What was your thesis?
Well, it was on what physical chemists refer to as standard cells. They are the ultimate standards against which we calibrate our voltmeters at the National Bureau of Standards. They maintain the ultimate standard cells in this country. Well, I was trying to develop a new type of cell for my doctoral program.
Who did you work with? Who was your...
Major professor then in physical chemistry was W.E. Henderson, who was known all over the country as co-author of the famous McPherson and Henderson freshman texts. At one time, their texts were in 250 colleges. They had two levels of college texts and a high school text. Yeah, I should think at that time it was the best known freshman
physical text. Chemistry.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, then what?
Well, of course, through the last of those graduate years, I had to think about what I was going to do or wanted to do as a graduate of Ohio State University in chemistry. And I was still thinking seriously of industry. I never quite lost that industrial viewpoint. But finally came down to an offer to teach at Colorado College. And they were then so poor they couldn't afford to have me go out and look at the place, but the president came through Columbus and interviewed me.
Where is Colorado College, just for the day?
Colorado Springs.
Colorado Springs.
Well, I shall never forget the president, a nicely bearded gentleman. He says, I can't pay you much, but we have magnificent views at Colorado Springs. Well, I thought about that. Finally, an offer came through in the electrochemical division, because my thesis had been really in electrochemistry, at the National Bureau of Standards, and also an offer from Purdue University. Three definite offers. I was holding off hoping to have an offer from the University of Michigan, because I'd really always wanted to go to the University of Michigan. I'd never seen the place. Well, I accepted finally the offer in Purdue University, without having seen it either. The only thing I knew about Purdue was a picture in my 8th grade geography book showing a Purdue engineering laboratory, which turned out to be the old mechanical engineering laboratory with the old pump.
Oh, I thought maybe they had locomotive there.
No, it didn't show the locomotive at that time. Well, at any rate, about 3 weeks after I accepted the Purdue offer, the offer came through from Michigan, and I was sick about my decision. The head of the department says, young man, you've accepted an offer at Purdue University, you're going to Purdue University. So I came really hoping that I would be able to stir again the offer at Michigan at the end of the first year at Purdue University. I didn't have a lot of enthusiasm at that time then about the university. I hadn't seen it, of course, at that time.
You came here then in 1919?
The fall of 1919.
Stone was president.
Yes, I was 2 years under Stone. In fact, that brings up the point then that this month ends my continuous 53rd year of employment in Purdue University. I believe that's a record.
Yes, sure. I would say it is a record. Jimmy James, who was formerly in biology, might have had more continuous relations with the university.
Yes, because he came as a student,
correct.
In 1914.
But nobody has exceeded this record as far as continuous service.
No, I came as an assistant professor in 1919.
Good heavens. Well, let's get into this. Who was the head of your department? What state was the department in? And just what was the department
here
like in 1919? Yes.
Well, P.N. Evans, Percy Norton Evans, was head of the department. an interesting side note possibly that many people here don't seem to realize, even among the chemists, that Purdue had a chemically trained president from 1900 until our new president came in 1971. He came last fall. 71 years, continuous, chemically trained president, and many in the university thought, I assume, it was time for a change. At any rate, we have a change. Well, President Stone, who was president when I arrived in 1919, had come in about 1889 as head of the chemistry department. He was a German-trained PhD in organic chemistry, and a very competent organic chemistry man, incidentally. He was a brother of Chief Justice Stone of the Supreme Court, that many people didn't seem to know about. Well, he was made vice president, I believe, about 1895, and at that time, then P.N. Evans was appointed head of the department. And when, he came in as, I guess that's right. Well, then President Stone, as vice president, was made president in 1900 on the death of President Smart, I believe, at that time. P.N. Evans then became head of the chemistry department and has had the longest continuous headship in the Department of Chemistry from 1900 to the summer of 1925 when he died. The department then, in 1919, was a pretty simple department. Late in the summer of 1919, I came over with a little basket of my standard cells, hoping to be able to continue this work at Purdue University, little realizing that there was no equipment here to do anything of the sort, but I did deposit the cells. They were never measured again because there was nothing here with which to measure. I happened to find A.R. Middleton, who I guess didn't have money enough to get away from the place. But at any rate, chemistry was a pretty quiet thing in Purdue University in those days in summer school. President Stone took off to climb the mountains, usually in Canada. He was a member of the Canadian mountain climbing groups and so on and so on. And Dr. Evans, head of the department, was a New Englander, took off to spend the summer with his family in Martha's Vineyard. So Purdue University, in the chemistry department at least, had as students the flunkers in freshman chemistry, and a few of those students would take some chemistry, beginning course, as something to work toward their advanced requirements for their certification as teachers. And that was it. There was no chemistry in the summertime.
How were our labs?
Well, the laboratory had been designed by, I suppose, with the help of President Stone and P.N. Evans, and what's now the Education Building. That building was built in 1904 and was considered, I suppose, a reasonably modern building at the time, although I'm now writing a paper about trends in laboratory construction, and I'm using it as an example of where all the hoods were supposed to be exhausted by a single fan in the attic. Now we try to get in modern laboratories a special exhaust fan for every individual hood. That marks one of the changes in chemistry buildings in these times. And incidentally, that building was designed with only the south half being built in 1904. There was to be a mirror image north half, and then the door would go in and the entrance would be a U corridor coming out at whichever one you went in, you'd come out the other if you wanted to go straight through the building. Well, the north half has never been built and never will be now, I assume. I was the seventh and baby member of the department in 1919. Now, we did have, I think, the best balanced in terms of training department on the campus. They were all PhDs. Chemistry has been an all PhD permanent staff, I should think, from at least 1910. It was a good staff in terms of variety and versatility of training and so on. But there was no research work.
Except you didn't have an MA or PhD program then?
There were a few master's degree students going through.
But no PhDs.
Oh, that didn't come on until 1928.
Was the chemistry also used to in engineering? Did you have engineering chemistry?
Well, our chief assignment in chemistry, now we had a few chemistry majors who went on to graduate school.
No.
But primarily our teaching assignment was a service course for engineers and agricultural students, home economic students, and in general the pharmacy students. I had all the four-year pharmacy students in my class mm-hmm. in those days.
But you didn't have, many just straight chem majors.
Oh no, very few.
In other words, the land grant spirit didn't work out for pure science.
No.
We were very interested because, as I understand it, you're supposed to have it. But this interesting here is because, as you know, I've been talking to Dean Potter, who's been telling me a lot about land grant.
Yes.
But he also makes the point that science should have come first, with the applied sciences springing from the inspiration of science.
Yeah.
Actually, that was not applicable here in 1919.
No, I would say not. No. As I think we had reasonably sound chemistry, a part of the chemistry was very well taught, part of it we've never improved upon in all these years, in my opinion.
Well, good fundamental teaching is going to be good fundamental teaching.
Fundamental teaching, yes. But it was teaching for all variety of students, engineers, and so on.
Well, then what happened after that? Take me through the history of the chemistry department as you see it.
Well, in 1925, Dr. Evans, head of the department, died rather suddenly from some kind of a kidney infection. And we'd had a big term. Well, going back just a little, I lived through the formation of the graduate school, really the start of a serious program, because my predecessor, E.G. Mahon, in analytical chemistry, had been a student of the famous Remsen of Johns Hopkins and had been inspired by him. And so he tried to put something of Hopkins' program into Purdue. He himself was a Purdue graduate in chemistry. So I considered him the father of the graduate school. He was the father of the local section of the American Chemical Society, of Sigma Xi. He was research-minded.
And how is his name spelled?
Mahon, M-A-H-I-N.
I'm doing this for the tape.
Yes. Well, at any rate, he had quite an aversion to what he considered the hypocrisy of slipping money under the tabletop to the athletes and still labeling them
scholars.
Yes, scholars and non-professionals. And he went so far with this that he was invited by... Just how they knew about it, I don't know, but he was invited by the Ohio College Association to give a talk on this subject in Columbus, Ohio. Well, I suppose he thought something might happen, because he asked me to read this speech before he went over there. He had it all typed and ready to read. And I read it. I saw nothing offensive. He didn't mention Purdue University in it. He went to Columbus and gave this speech. The next morning, the big headline across the Chicago Tribune was, "Purdue professor criticizes Big Ten." Well, that started the trouble. He was called to the president's office, told he'd...
Now, is this President Elliott?
Elliott.
Elliott came in 1923.
Yes.
All right.
He was called to the president's office and told he committed academic suicide, although President Elliott had previously promised Mahon, who is the father of the graduate school, in my opinion, that he would be the first dean of the graduate school. Well, it created so much turmoil that the ultimate end of the thing in the late summer of 1925 was E.G. Mahon resigned and went, unbelievably, to Notre Dame University. And he was given every privilege up there. Within 5 years, he was given the faculty $500 award at commencement time for being the best teacher in Notre Dame University. And he was told there he could say anything, do anything he wanted to. Presumably because they knew it would make a difference up there, anyway. Well, he should have been the new head of the department in the summer then, 1925, as well as the new dean of the graduate school.
This is largely then Elliott's doing.
I consider strictly so. The alumni descended on him and demanded that Mahon be fired. Well, he wasn't fired, but there are ways of freezing people out. Doesn't have to be fired abruptly. He left, at any rate, the late summer of 1925. So A.R. Middleton was appointed acting head, and Dr. Elliott set out to find a new head. He decided that he wouldn't point anybody within the department head. In fact, he made the statement, very uncomplimentary to the chemistry department, and he considered it the sleepiest department of chemistry that he knew anything about, because he never could find a light in the building at night, nothing going on. And there probably wasn't much going on at night, except E.G. Mahon was probably doing consulting work. He did a lot of consulting work in metallurgy, physical metallurgy. Well, Dr. Middleton was the acting head of the department through then the year 1925 and 6. In late summer of 1926, R.B. Moore, who had been the chief chemist of the United States Bureau of Mines and then left there to become manager of the world-famous Dorr Company, D-O-R-R, Company of New York, who make the great mixers for chemical engineering installations all over the world. He was general manager in New York. Well, apparently he didn't like that so well, but at any rate, he left and left a $25,000 salary and came to Purdue for a $7,900 salary, $5,500 as head of the chemistry department, and $2,400 extra for being dean of science. He was a joint appointee, as head and dean.
Now, he preceded Dean Enders then.
Well, he succeeded the famous Dean Coulter.
Yeah.
Coulter had been retired, and so he took over the new appointment there, as well as the headship of the Department of Chemistry. And he was research-minded, although he certainly didn't have a research reputation himself. He'd had a little experience at the University of Missouri in radiochemistry, and he had been down to Butler University briefly and played around a little bit more with what little facilities they had with radiochemistry. He developed some interest, at any rate, in radiochemistry. And while the Bureau of Mines, he got interested in helium as a substitute for hydrogen for balloons. And I considered him the father then of the application of helium for lighter than air aircraft. So he was constantly watching the progress of these great balloons filled with helium. There had been this famous explosion of the Hindenburg, which was filled with hydrogen.
That was in 37.
Yes. So that Dr. Moore came in, in fact the fall he came, he'd been given the Perkin Medal, which is the highest honor in this country for an industrial chemist. And he'd had the Longstreth and the Potts Medals from the Franklin Institute previously for his work with radium and helium. So he came in with an unequaled flourish for someone coming in from the outside. And that time, he could have had almost anything he wanted because of the prestige that he arrived. Well, President Elliott told him he wanted some research work started, a research program in chemistry, and the dean started out to do that. And then he took a look at the chemistry department, and I guess he thought it was pretty sleepy, and the facilities were relatively poor. He couldn't do much research-wise in that building. So he gave hardly a second thought to the doubling of size of the building, which had been planned to be doubled, and said, it isn't worth doing. We won't try to adapt this. I'll go before the trustees and tell them we must have a fine new building. And I consider that one of his top achievements, because we'd had no such building on the campus.
Now, we're sitting in this building now that was planned after 37?
No, this was planned in 28.
In 28. Did you plan it?
Yes. But in December of 1927, he decided he wanted to do this. And he'd gone before the trustees. He'd had a good experience at the Bureau of Mines, going before congressional committees and arguing for money for the Bureau. So he convinced the trustees that we should have a fine new chemistry building. And I consider that one of his top achievements. 1927, he asked me to plan the building. That I consider one of his questionable assignments, because I'd had no experience in planning anything except a house for myself, and I didn't do a very good job of that.
Well, now just let me say something for the record then. The growth of the physical properties of the chemistry buildings at Purdue has been under your, at least, if not supervision, at least under your eye and aegis and your consulting opinion. Because if you did the first one, you've done the last. You've done this beautiful new building that's coming in now, haven't you?
Well, I think that's a fair statement. But at any rate, January 1st, 1928, Dean Moore, R.B. Stewart, and I started for Boston, New Year's Day. R.B. Stewart went along because he wanted to look at girls' dormitories. We didn't have women's dormitories at that time, and he went along to look over that possibility. So I saw a few dormitories that I otherwise would not have seen, because R.B. Stewart insisted on going. I generally went with him Not that I was greatly interested in them, but I went along to see them. So we made a trip to see the fine new laboratories of the East. New York University, Columbia, Princeton, Yale, Harvard, MIT, Cornell was that first visit. 2 weeks later, then, we went west and saw about an equal number of laboratories. So that was the start of the planning of what later became known as the Wetherill Chemistry Laboratory.
Is this the Wetherill Chemistry Lab we're in now?
Yes.
I always think of the chemistry building.
Well, I do too.
The official title is the Wetherill.
Well, because Mr. Wetherill hadn't earned any money at this time, and not for many years later was this done, and so the name on the front was chemistry. And I still think, maybe it's a fine point in English, but I think it should not have been Wetherill Chemistry Laboratory, but the word chemistry was in the stone. It should have been Wetherill Chemical Laboratory. All the people of the East who have their laboratories named, their letterheads read Frick Chemical Laboratory, Malincroft Chemical Laboratory.
That's right. That is correct.
So, but this one, because the word chemistry was in the stone, where they put Wetherill west of the chemistry name and laboratory east, so it stands Wetherill Chemistry Laboratory. And that came about, of course, many years later, because in 1929, when the bids were let, early spring of 1929, they came in about $1,340,000. And President Elliott said, there's $350,000 available, do with it what you can. So we had to slice the building in three parts, and there was about enough money to do the east third of the building. It's cut on the first architectural break, as a matter of fact. And the first dirt was dug in May 1st, 1929. 16 months later, we moved in and started classes. The present building was to have been done in 27 months. It's going to be more than 3 years before we ever get in.
Well, what happened with Mr. Moore in the department?
Well, he started...
The direction of my question, the thrust is that Purdue has become established, or famous, in certain areas of research now, as
yes.
well as teaching. Would you, in other words, can we talk about that?
He started what President Elliott wanted started, a research program in the Department of Chemistry. And a young man added to the department, he was careful to add somebody that he had a reasonable expectation that they would develop in that particular direction. Henry Haas was one of his earliest appointments. That might have been his first appointment, as a matter of fact.
Now, for the record, let us say that Henry Haas ultimately became a famous chemist and head of the Department of Chemistry at Purdue, leaving Purdue to go into industry as a research man and consultant and head of a program. That's just for the table.
Yes.
Now, excuse me.
Well, his judgment of Henry Haas was sound. He proved to be a very sound research man. My own personal feeling is it was unfortunate for chemistry that he didn't remain a research man and develop. I think he would have been one of the top organic chemists in this country if he confined himself to that and not aspired to be president of the university, develop things politically instead of chemically. He was a very, and remains, a very keen man, chemically speaking. No question about that. Well, the graduate school then was officially started in 1928. So we didn't begin any PhDs until 1928, and Dean Potter presented the first one. And I might put in the record this most interesting meeting of Sigma Xi, this going back several years previously when we were still arguing as to whether we should have a graduate school or not. Mahon was trying to get the thing started. And I shall never forget the evening, the dinner meeting, at which Dean Potter presented a written paper. He wanted to give a reasonably good speech. He always wrote it out and read it, citing all the reasons why Purdue University should not have a graduate school. We had limited resources, we should limit them and develop the best undergraduate program, but we were able to do that. And the most unexpected support for the program came from G.I. Christie, then the director of the experiment stations, and it was expected he would not favor the program because they didn't have a general research program of the quality that we were trying to start, and he gave his talk extemporaneously and one of the soundest supporting speeches of the evening for the development of the program. That was a memorable night.
That is, you're talking a graduate program in chemistry.
Well, the whole university.
Oh, the whole university,
yeah.
Oh.
Oh, the whole university. See, the graduate school hadn't been started yet. Well, it got started then in 1928. And Mann had left, the man who'd been appointed, who'd been promised the deanship, well, he'd long since gone, so that another man was appointed dean, and he got the thing underway. And we granted in connection with Dean Potter, I think it's interesting to note, he, the man who opposed the formation of the graduate school, presented the first candidate for a PhD degree, namely Dr. Zucrow.
Zucrow, one of the, almost a genius.
Yeah.
If not a genius.
He was the first man to get a PhD. Well, we got the chemistry program rolling slowly. Money was pretty scarce in terms of modern budgets at any rate. And our first two PhDs in chemistry came through in 1930. Fred Allen and C.B. Pollard were our first two PhDs. So from that in 1930 to 2 years ago, I believe, we had 75 PhDs in chemistry. That very superficially compares the status of the program in 1930 in chemistry to 1970.
Mm. Suddenly we had 75 men coming up that year.
PhDs in chemistry. That's the Department of Chemistry.
That means the department must have grown tremendously in numbers of full professors.
Well, from seven in 1919, when I came, I was the seventh. Added, it'd been six, I was the seventh. We had around 35, I suppose, in 19. See, it hadn't grown proportionately to the number of students we turned out. Well, through those years then, from 1930 to 1970, a 40-year period, I prepared a little historical survey of the status of chemistry in Indiana at the sesquicentennial.
Now, may I ask if this pamphlet could be attached to your, when you send in, your edited typescript, could that be made part of your edited typescript for the archives?
I have reprints.
That I meant. Add the reprint to it.
Well, the point I was going to make there, that in, and this is according to the survey of Mr. Carter, who made this survey of graduate education in the United States, according to his count, from 1930 to, I've forgotten whether it's 1964, but about that date that his first report came out, we had grown from nothing in PhDs to the sixth largest producer of PhDs in chemistry in this country. Now that says nothing about the quality, it's numbers of PhDs.
Are you with the heads of the department or the men in the department who pushed this program?
Well, Dean Moore, of course, in a brief period here, he moved into this new laboratory, first third of Wetherill Laboratory, in September 1930. And it was obvious to us, particularly when we looked back a little, that the man was really not up to par. He was not feeling well. And by the middle of December, he was sick. He was taken to Mayo's. He was taken from there to the famous Memorial Hospital in New York with their great supply of radium. And just after the new year, he died. Memorial Hospital of a brain tumor. So we were in trouble again. And Dr. Middleton was appointed acting head of the department once more. But this time, President Eliot set up a triumvirate with Dr. Moore, or Dr. Middleton, chairman of the trio, Dr. Ralph Nelson in charge of research, and I was designated director of instruction. So I was supposed to snoop around and see what might be done to help out the instructional program, the lectures, the recitations, the laboratory, and so on. Kind of a delicate appointment, but I tried to do what I thought could be done. Well, we ran this trio appointment for 7 years. And in the meantime, President Eliot had offered the headship here to at least two dozen bright young people, including Harold Urey, the Nobel Prize winner, and several others. Well, they just wouldn't come here, as a matter of fact. And finally, in 19...
You know why? I suppose each individual had a variety of reasons.
Well, I think so. Well, they were all at well-established research institutions. And they saw that although we had the start of a building here, we didn't have much in it yet at that time. And they just apparently didn't want to leave their facilities and come here and wrestle trying to get a new program going, develop programs for the others, and so on and so on. At any rate, they did not come. So 10 years after he came here, on the invitation of Dr. Moore, Henry Haas was appointed head of the department in 1937. And he, of course, was really research-minded. And he got the, going back to about the financing of the chemistry building, Wetherill Laboratory, Dean Moore told around pretty generously that he had the man spotted who was going to provide the money to pay for the new chemistry building, $1,340,000 building. This turned out to be Mr. J.K. Lilly, member of the Board of Trustees. Apparently Mr. Lilly heard about this ultimately, and not again after that did we hear this proposal, but he contributed the first money for the Purdue Research Fund, $15,000, Purdue Research Foundation grants. And Henry Haas was given this first grant, and E.T. McBee was the first Purdue Research Fellow then on this money provided by Mr. Lilly. Well, Haas had been out 3 years in industry after his graduate school work at Ohio State, and he thought he saw real possibilities in using the gas escaping so largely from the wells in West Virginia and Western Virginia. And chlorine was a very cheap material, and he wanted to start chlorinating natural gas to see what he could get, preparing chlorinated hydrocarbons. And E.T. McBee started that program here at Purdue University. And I like to say one of the reasons I've survived reasonably well is that I got chlorinated and developed a chlorinated skin, and have been reasonably immune to most everything that happened in the chemistry department since. Because the ventilation, and this was still in the old building, and there was no ventilation. So when the chlorine got loose, it went everywhere. Well, this was the start of really a very successful program. That is, Haas, his students, later McBee, who succeeded Haas as head of the department, and his students chlorinated and later fluorinated anything that would sit still, and prepared all sorts of compounds, hundreds of different compounds.
Here, Mr. Brown came in.
Well, Brown came in under Haas as head of the department. Yeah. At any rate, by the time, going back to Dr. Haas, of course, it was obvious we were going to have a new president, because President Elliott was reaching retirement age.
About 1945,
yes.
During the war.
Yes. He had forced the retirement age limitation on the staff, had to retire by 70. Well, finally it came his turn. And he didn't think so much.
As I understand, he protested strongly.
He didn't think so much of the idea then. But the trustee says, you put this into Purdue University, you agree to abide by this thing.
And did Dean Enders have much influence on this program, or did he just sign his name to things?
No, after Dean Moore died, then Enders was appointed dean. And he had, a rather insignificant influence on anything, because Haas, later McBee, paid no attention to him, and just sidestepped him and went to, maybe I shouldn't put this in the tape, you can clip it out if you want to.
I don't see any reason why we should clip it out, because this is your estimate, and let's just say that this is estimate of one man who's here to watch.
Yeah, that's my estimate.
That's all right. Others have done the same sort of thing. So it's, I don't think it's any disrespect to Enders particularly.
Yeah.
I knew the man too.
Yeah.
And he had many fine qualities, but one of them was not running the chemistry department.
No.
And perhaps with young, you might say young Turks like Haas and McBee, he understood what his role was. His role was to sign papers. Is this right?
That's right. That's right. No, they just calmly disregarded him and went directly to the president.
Well, it says a great deal about President Elliott that he permitted this kind of procedure.
He says that I could tell you a story about that, but we won't put this in the tape.
No.
I sat in his office and listened to this.
But,
well, at any rate, there was to be a new president after President Elliott had to retire, and Dr. Haas was ambitious. There had been other famous chemistry presidents like Remsen at Johns Hopkins and Elliott at Harvard. Why couldn't he be the next president of Purdue? So he devoted himself fairly vigorously to developing the prospects in that direction. And when he didn't get that, that undoubtedly marked his very severe interest, drop in interest in Purdue University, and he began to look around and ultimately left and went into industry and remained in industry until his retirement.
It's very interesting because when I came here, I met the man and he said he was interested in becoming the next dean.
Well, he would have accepted the deanship. Of course, when he finally didn't get the deanship, and Ayers was appointed, that ended it just like that.
Yeah.
You know. But he previously had wanted to be head of the department.
Mm-hmm.
But he was almost anti-church, and one summer gave a series of seminar talks to the graduate students, almost against religion. And this reached the local clergy sooner or later. And then he regretted that, because one of the requests made to me by E.T. McBee was to help support H.B. Haas for the presidency, and he himself, McBee, had been asked to go and interview all Lafayette clergymen and assure them that H.B. Haas was satisfactory for president.
Oh, my. To think that that influence should even exist. Oh, dear. Oh, that's fascinating.
Well, I've lived through various interesting things.
And then you, then, McBee succeeded Haas, is that correct?
Yes.
And was here until his elevation into the sphere of managing a chemical company. I've forgotten. I have Mr. McBee's interview on tape, so the date
yes.
is important.
Yeah. Well, he succeeded Haas in 1949.
Yes.
And then until, well, let's see, he was head for 18 years, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And what happened to the department during that period? I knew it grew tremendously.
Well, under Haas, I'd like to make one point. I have nothing but admiration for his mentality. He's a very keen man. Was here, still is. But he set out to make what I consider an institute of organic chemical research. So shortly after he became head, 70% of our graduate students were majoring in organic chemistry, because he just wouldn't allow the rest of us to take on many. He was going to develop a famous organic chemistry, spurred on by the great fame of the University of Illinois, no doubt. Well, I think Dr. McBee sensed that that wasn't a very wise thing. Many of the staff were unhappy about it, so he started to ease off the emphasis on organic chemistry and let some other things develop. And that has undoubtedly enormously benefited the department, the general morale. We have a very sound and capable organic staff. It may be the best staff all through today, but the graduate students are not the dominant force that they were under Haas. And things expanded. When McBee came in as head of the department, whether he had a promise of this when he became head, I do not know, although I suspect he had, that the remaining two-thirds of this building would be completed. Because it did start not long after that. Well, by this time, in the meantime, we of course had, because of the great upsurge in numbers of students in freshman chemistry, we'd had to do various things here on a temporary basis to accommodate them. The old gymnasium which the girls were in, the former electrical engineering laboratory next door, and I went through several stages of planning to take care of that. Well, and finally after the war, we acquired these four so-called temporary buildings.
Which had become permanent.
Well, I warned Dr. Frank Martin at the time, and he moved in those. Incidentally, I planned the laboratories within those four buildings and classrooms. That both he and I would be retired long before he got out of that place. Well, we've now been in there 26 years. And finally, we're going to get out next fall, this fall, sometime. Well, one of the things Dr. McBee did was to throw freshman chemistry completely out of this present building. And that has meant renovation and changes time after time. And at that time, of course, the big change came then, because I had this building designed to accommodate 4,000 students. Dr. Martin had estimated in 1928 that we ought to plan for 4,000 students. Next fall, we will have just under 4,000 freshman students. Purdue University, you see, 42 years later, his estimates were extremely sound. And Dean Moore, the head of the department, asked me to plan for facilities for 80 graduate students in this building. 2 years ago, we had 400. So his estimate of the future, you see, was completely unsound. Frank Martin's were very sound. Well, that's an incidental thing, but I, of course, watch
over. No, but it does affect the shape and development of any work involving laboratories.
Oh, yes.
It's a matter of space, isn't it?
Well, at any rate, in 1946, I believe, we had to do something. We acquired these old storage buildings from the West Coast. It didn't even have any windows, nothing. And they were moved here, and we put windows in them and developed them into a reasonable working laboratory, as a matter of fact. We spent $80,000 for desks, and those were sized, designed, to put into the new building as soon as we got the new building. 26 years later, we're not even going to consider moving them. We're just abandoning them. What's left of the termites haven't eaten up in the old building up there. Well, at that particular time, then, Dr. McBee made the rather important decision that freshman chemistry would be moved out of this building. And that left all my plans for 4,000 students here not very well adapted for work that he wanted to put in. So we got busy and redesigned the whole back of the building for research purposes. And that is what it has been converted into. So the present building on the back is not at all the building that I planned in 1928.
And what about the new building? What is the new building going to be?
Well, I'd like to say one thing. Going clear back to 1928, when President Elliott said that, you know, $350,000. If we could have borrowed $800,000, we could have completed the whole laboratory in 1929 and 30. Well, we couldn't because of the state limitation on the $1 million debt limit. I think as things have developed, it was a very fortunate break and we didn't get that. Well, 25 years passed before we did stir the money to start the completion of this building. So it was finally dedicated. We moved in the first part in 1930. It was 1955 that we finally dedicated the laboratory. And once more, back to Dean Moore, he'd become a personal friend of Madame Curie. In fact, he was the man who handed her the gram of radium which the women of America had bought to present to her on her first trip to America. Well, he, because of his interest in radiochemistry and his friendship with Madame Curie, he had the inspiration on the dedication of this first third of the building to have a kind of symposium here, a three-day symposium on what was going on in radiochemistry throughout the world. And he invited her to be here as the chief speaker at the dedication. And at that time he says, well, now for these spandrel stones, the names that go around the building, he says, I want a stone prepared for Madame Curie with her name. And well, on the building, I had Boyle, the famous Boyle's Law chemist. His name was in the alphabetical place where Madame Curie was to go. So I had to then tell the architects to put Mr. Boyle in the basement and get a new stone cut with the name Curie on it. And she would have been, had she gotten here, the only living chemist with a name on the building. Well, she was sick and died and couldn't get here, so the building was never dedicated in that fashion. Then coming to back to 1955, we did dedicate then, of course, the final. Well, at this point, mathematically or economically, $800,000 would have completed the building in 1930. It took $4 million in 1955, 25 years later, to do that same thing. Buildings' costs had gone up just five times. Now, I said we were fortunate in respect, and this is a very interesting lesson I've learned in chemistry, that in planning a building, once you make things, I think this is an outstanding point, the most difficult thing to do, plan the building just as flexible and adaptable as possible. It is impossible to see ahead 25 years what will be needed. Had I completed the building in 1930, there would have been no provision whatever, and we couldn't easily have put anything in. I doubt if we could have put anything in for radiochemistry. The atom had been split in the meantime. Radiochemistry was the big subject by 1955. We had to have a laboratory for radiochemistry. And we did copy on a small scale the famous argon laboratory at Chicago. They gave us their blueprints, and this is a small argon installation that we have here. Well, that illustrates one of the things that happens in planning of buildings. And we just moved outside somewhere and built a radio laboratory, I suppose, had we not been held up for these 25 years.
What do you think about the new one? Is this sufficiently flexible, or do you hope it is? Do you have any guesses?
Well, I put everything that I know into arguing for flexibility. I've been overruled. Some things I don't like about the new building, I think it's a mistake, because they didn't take seriously what I said about this point of flexibility. We don't have the flexibility I should have liked to see, which we could have had. But we have a group of young people that know a good deal. They want it the other way. Only this morning I took two guests through to show them. They immediately saw the point. You stopped flexibility at this point because you did it this way, which we didn't have to do.
Who succeeded McBee as head of the chemistry department?
Well, Foster, J.F. Foster.
Any great change in policy or direction?
No. No significant change. He hasn't been head very long yet. The new building was already underway, and he more or less tried to just keep the thing going on.
How do you rate Purdue's department nationally and in the Big Ten?
Well, I depend somewhat upon these ratings, the famous Carter studies. He's published a revised study now, the ratings of the graduate schools, and I've forgotten specifically, I think we're rated about 15th in the country of all the chemistry departments.
I've been told the reason for that is that the men who did the rating were all were famous graduates of Illinois who put their department first when it shouldn't be.
Well, this study I made for 150 years of chemistry in Indiana, I have the figures in there for Illinois, and they have about twice the number of PhDs of anybody else. Now, there's one thing one has to keep in mind, that's a little inflated, in that under the head of the Department of Chemistry, there are all the chemical engineering graduates and all the biochemistry graduates, and those are separate departments here. So if we counted those at Purdue, we'd certainly be higher than we now are in that standing.
Well, what was our general reputation in scholarship? Good, bad, indifferent? I think it depends a lot who you talk to.
For example,
there Professor Brown is an internationally known man. If you work with Brown, it means you're probably a good chemist.
Yes.
But I've heard we've had others too. Haas, I think, and McBee have some reputation.
Oh yes.
Day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, they turned out a lot of PhDs and some very good men. Well, I think we are a good department.
Would you put us among the first 10 in the United States?
I think probably.
Not just general rating.
I think that's a fair statement.
Yes. Based on achievement.
Yes.
And you can pick or choose, probably not the first. Harvard may be the first or something like that. But
now, right now, I have a minority here. A report that was made just a year ago by Recknitz of University of Buffalo, and he studied the status of analytical chemistry in this country, graduate work, mm-hmm. and so on. And whether his basis of evaluation is sound, well, who knows? I don't. I'm just reporting what he decided. And in that particular report, why, Purdue ranks number one.
In analytical
chemistry. Yeah.
How generally do we compare with our peers in the Big Ten as a department, would you say?
Well, I think we're now in the Big Ten because they were running graduate schools long before we were. I consider it a great accomplishment that from 1930 to 1963 or 4, we came up to this sixth position that I didn't mention. Because Illinois, Wisconsin, Chicago, Michigan, Ohio State had had graduate schools for years and turned out many students. Mm-hmm. Illinois had a famous staff, as had the Chicago. Michigan staff was good back in those early days. Not so good now, or out of it, I think. So I think we really achieved very significantly in coming up and competing with them, because they all looked down upon us. We didn't get first choice graduate students in those early days, because if they could get in the other places, that's where they went.
What are the great graduate chemistry schools?
Chemistry schools?
Yeah.
Well, the Carter study rates the University of California, Berkeley as number one. I don't quite understand educationally why we should have that as the center of riots when it's such a great, famous graduate school.
Is it famous in chemistry?
Oh, yes. They have three or four Nobel Prize winners there on the staff all the time. They have half a dozen now, but it's that kind of school. Well, we never had a Nobel Prize winner in the state of Indiana.
The only man who is a graduate of Purdue and is a Nobel Prize winner is a Professor Purcell, who is at Harvard.
Yeah, physics.
Physics.
That's right. Well, he didn't recognize him until after he got his Nobel Prize. And well, they gave an honorary doctorate.
Isn't there a general hope that Professor Brown will be given the accolade one of these days and become a Nobel Prize winner?
Well, incidentally, he's been nominated for the prize, you know, by one of the signers of that particular document. So we're waiting with much interest for the decision this year. Or
let's hope that he makes it.
Yeah, some.
Because he is a fine research candidate.
Oh, he's an outstanding man. No question about that. No, I think we're one of the good departments. We're not the top department, in my opinion, but we're one of the good departments in this country. We have, I think, a very well-balanced staff, which isn't true of many places. Analytical chemistry is very low in school after school. Partly maybe that's the reason we're standing this off at the moment. It's just disappeared.
Do you know one thing we haven't talked about is your own personal research and academic interests? You have the reputation of being an outstanding, spectrographer. Am I saying it right?
Spectroscopist.
Spectroscopist in the United States. One of the handful.
Well, I would hate to say that. That evaluation.
Well, this is given to me by one of your colleagues.
Yeah. Well, this started interestingly to me. I think back about it once in a while because I came over here with this handful of standard cells, you see, expecting to go on electrochemistry. My master's thesis had been in electrochemistry. That was really my compelling interest if I had one when I reached Purdue University. And had there been equipment here, I certainly would have gone on in that direction. Mm-hmm. I think now I was fortunate I didn't find that. Because that particular area has not developed through the years. I would have had to change to something else anyway. Well, my change came about, I suppose, primarily, you see that bunch of colored tubes back there?
Yes.
I like to do experiments before my classes, partly to keep them awake, do something once in a while, you see, show them something, mm-hmm. appeal to their eyes, not just their ears. So I made up colored solutions to show them certain pH changes. And sometimes those things would fade. I didn't get to it that particular lecture. I saved them for the next one. By the time I got to the next lecture, the things had faded out and I had to remake them in my private laboratory. Well, I got tired of that and began to look into the possibility of using solutions which wouldn't fade, a different kind of solution. And if you see that little setup on top, which I call my solution spectrum,
yes.
Those solutions were
now
made.
Now there are six colors.
Yeah, well you see they're approximately the painted spectrum here.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if you recall, Colonel Carpenter, the fellow that shot himself and his wife down along the river.
Oh, yes.
Well,
yes.
He painted that spectrum for me.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
And he was a pretty good artist, as a matter of fact. Well, at any rate, those solutions.
So let's just say for the tape that this is a framed spectrum of colors.
Yes.
More or less resembling the colors that one might find in the rainbow.
Yes.
All right.
Because a spectrum, the artists tell me, is one of the most difficult things to paint. Because from the farthest red to the farthest blue, there should be no lines of demarcation, just gradually shade from one into the other.
Yes.
Well, every picture, that's an oil painting up there, every picture, something stands out, you see. That's the one thing they don't do, is just shade everything in, nothing to nothing. So I tried for 10 years to get an artist to paint me a spectrum. None of the local artists would touch it. And Colonel Carpenter was in my class. I was talking on color once, and my real interest there was the measurement of color numerically. Not with words. And he heard me say that I'd not been unable to get anybody to paint a spectrum for me. He says, I'd like to try that. If you can get materials for me, I'll try it. So right in the center of his wife's living room, he set up his easel and painted a spectrum 2 feet by 4 feet, twice the width of this. And he had the paint cans all around sitting on the rug there. I went to see this thing once in the midst of the painting. And she must have been a very cooperative wife, I think, to stand that. But he finally painted it, and we then cut it in half and framed them, and he had the other half. I wonder what became of it after his death, and this is my half. Well, now back to the solutions. I made those in 1922, and they looked to be practically what I made up in 1922, so they've had 50 years of exposure to light and have not faded. Well, this has been a problem to prepare color standards. You see another direction in which we have these things are the paint samples to get at the hardware stores and so on. which are not very good matches frequently, but you get paint on the house, you wonder what it was you looked at in the hardware store, and so on. Well, that was started my interest then, to get things experimentally which I could keep from week to week and show this class. Out of that, then, ultimately came 30 years of work in absorption spectroscopy.
Books? Papers? How many?
Oh, there are 50 or 60 papers in that field, I suppose, and one 600-page book on analytical absorption spectroscopy.
May I ask for, add for the benefit of the tape and the editors, that you will give a list of your papers with the title of your book and along with your vita?
Well,
be appended to this. We'd like to have that.
If you could want them, there are over 200 papers. And
well, we'd just like to have the names of
half a dozen books. If you want them, you can have.
Yes.
Yes.
Would you do that?
Yes.
And just the books that you've written and the papers that you've written will be just added as an appendix.
Yes. All right.
All right. That's all right. Your secretary probably has a list, surely.
Well, most of my graduate students, not all of them, then for 30 years after I finally got a measuring instrument, which was bought incidentally by Professor Ferry in the physics department, which had no experimental program. One of the things Dean Moore had to do was start not only research in chemistry, which he didn't have so much trouble doing, but to start it also in the physics department, and that's when he imported Lark Horowitz. And Lark Horowitz pestered him every afternoon at 4 o'clock in his office. He wished later he hadn't hired Lark Horowitz. Well, anyway,
Horowitz is a very, very great man.
Oh, yes. Oh, that really sparked the physics department. It just turned the thing over. It was a non-research teaching department. Well, at any rate, Professor Ferry bought, for lecture demonstration, this spectrophotometer. And I still have this down here in a showcase as a museum instrument. I consider it the start of absorption spectroscopy for analytical chemists in this country. Well, they never used it in the physics department except these few lecture demonstrations, and Professor Ferry was squeezed out of the department, and so I inherited the instrument. And Frank Martin was my first graduate student on that instrument.
I didn't know that Professor Martin was your graduate student.
Well, I had him as an undergraduate. Even his class has its 50th reunion this coming
is
spring.
Is that so? I had no idea that
he's a 23 graduate. Well, I had him 2 years before that. 1921, I had him in my class. Well, he was my first student then. That was the first measurement of color which we made then with an instrument. And ultimately, 1934, I gambled Purdue's meager $2,500 research fund, all of it, to the dismay of my colleagues who wanted to borrow, gambled that on a single General Electric recording spectrophotometer, the first one made in this country. We still have that in the attic. And out of that, then, grew this research program of about 30 years.
And your interest?
Yes.
That has been your special interest?
Well, research-wise, yes.
Yeah.
Now, of course, an important side interest all these years, from 1921 on, was library work, chemical literature. Because my first book, was entitled Chemical Publications, and I started a course in 1921 in library work, chemical literature, and that's still running. In fact, I'm in the process of getting ready for a fifth edition of that book right now.
What do you do, add to it constantly?
No, the big problem is throw out the obsolete and add the new, and I may say, personally, I consider it more difficult to rewrite a book than to write a new one, because I must eliminate. Publisher says keep the pages to a certain limit. Throw out the old, put in the new. Well, everything I throw out is part of me. I put that in there in the first place. Thought serious about it before I put it in. I don't like to throw myself away like that.
But you still have to.
That's the dilemma of a divided mind.
It's also the dilemma of scholarship. Well, you get to the place where you discover that, you know, I do in my field. That's one reason why I in particular, because I don't like to write too much. I'm not a very good writer, but I do find that things that 30 years ago we thought, well, now that won't go, suddenly it becomes topics for theses and books.
Yes, that's right.
Do you find that true in chemistry?
Yes. Yeah. Well, chemical literature remains one of my real interest because I'm one of the section editors of the famous journal Chemical Abstracts.
How many languages do you read? You read in English, German, French?
Well, I try to read German and French, that's all. And of course now I wonder, because there's a real move on to abandon all foreign language. I don't see how we're going to get along without German, at least in chemistry, because our grade reference works are still in German.
The duty of the scientist is to know what's going on in the world of science.
Yes.
And it doesn't make much difference how you learn it, but how can you absorb it if you don't know some language?
Yeah. Now, I think that'll be a mistake, but that's up for discussion here now in the graduate school, to abandon the foreign languages.
Are we really doing better work than we used to? Has the spirit of research or graduate work changed a great deal in chemistry?
Well, let me answer teaching first. I don't think we're doing a better teaching job, by and large, than we were 50 years ago. Now, that's heresy here in the department. I know that's my own feeling about it, but these fellows that dispute me don't know what was going on 50 years ago. We had a magnificent course in qualitative analysis under Middleton, whom I've mentioned as acting head twice. And as an example of that, I talked one night in Miami, Florida, 20 years ago, and an old man sat in the front row, gray-headed. I thought he didn't look very interesting to what I was saying. I was talking about spectroscopy and so on, colorimetry. Just as soon as I finished, he jumped up and shook my hand and said, "Dr. Mullen, I want you to understand, I didn't come to hear you. I have the slightest interest in what you said. I just want to ask you a question. What became of Mitty?" I haven't seen or heard of him for 25 years. He left an indelible impression upon me as a student. Well, that's the kind of teacher he was. Never did any research work. But I meet these classes now that are coming back for the 50th reunion, my first class. I met one here at the last Gale week. And they remember my chip, just one teacher 50 years ago, A.R. Middleton. See, we don't have anybody like that now. We're not doing that. But we are turning out lots of research papers. Well, there's that general change. Now we're doing sound teaching. But in the sense of a man devoting himself to his teaching, as Herschel Hunt did until he had to retire this spring. When he ran a laboratory, he was in that place. The laboratory started, he stayed till the students left. Every laboratory. He conducted his own recitations. He didn't turn them over to teaching assistants. Well, you can't publish research papers sitting on a stool in the laboratory or talking to students about their family troubles, so on and so on. The two things just don't mix. So, here's the
difference. Mr. Hunt retired too soon. As I understand, the thrust and drive of our new president, Mr. Hansen, is back to that kind of contact between teacher and student.
Well, see, Hunt wasn't thought very well of by, I'd say, most of our young generation here, because he just didn't know enough to publish research papers, you see, and develop a reputation. But his students will never forget him. Now, he was a different teacher than Middleton, but just the same, they'll not forget Herschel Hunt. He didn't have the foundation in chemistry that Middleton had. Middleton was a Cornell man. He really knew his inorganic chemistry. Tremendous knowledge of the subject. But he didn't publish any papers.
Is publishing essential in your field, or make a reputation?
Well, I've said many times, sitting down in the laboratory talking with the students about their troubles and trying to help them with their things and so on, doesn't accumulate credits in the president's office. And I don't mean just Purdue University. I think it's true nearly every university today.
And yet your great research reputations are based upon the fact that a man will take 9 or 10 research students and work with them at a time.
Yeah, of course, he works with the graduate students, that's right.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Now, Dr. Brown, who's our best-known man, well, he has at least 20 students all the time. He never teaches anything. He never meets a class. He hasn't met a class for years. The undergraduates don't even know him. See, it's unfortunate. Here's our best-known man. They have no contact with him. Of course, he writes papers. He ran a seminar course or something at UCLA one summer, out there 5 weeks. He told me when he came back that he'd been able to write 14 papers during those 5 weeks.
You write papers differently than one does in my subject.
Well, he writes his own student's papers. Now, he and I, you see, are like this, as far as that's concerned, because I warned the student if he's going to major with me that I would not write his thesis and I wouldn't write his research paper. If he couldn't tell the world what he'd done, he wasn't fit for a PhD yet.
You don't put your name on it either, do you?
Well, if they want me to. Their name always goes on first.
That's...
And I put it this way. Editors argued with me, we don't publish this way. I'd say, J.C. Guyon with M.G. Mellon. I always told them, now, if you want this under your own name, it's your work, you put it that way. But they wanted to, they hoped to profit a little from having my name on the paper, I guess. But it was their name first with M.G. Mellon. Well, the editors wanted always and. I changed that and proved.
Now, may I ask you, what are your hobbies? What do you do for fun?
Raise trees.
Raise trees and read.
I was raised on a farm.
That's right. I wondered if anything would...
Yeah, early in my life, somewhere or other, I got interested in growing trees. And I have trees in Pennsylvania now that little things 3 feet tall are now 2 feet in diameter and 60 feet tall. Tulip poplars. So beautiful trees. So the trees now are one of my hobbies. I have 20 different kinds of trees on my lot out there in Rivermay. Next thing is music. I, much against my wishes, my mother insisted I take piano lessons, really read organ lessons first, and finally she, in the Roosevelt I Depression, why she bought a piano.
We've always gone through this, haven't we? All of us have to take piano lessons by yeah. Firm and determined mothers. You're going to make little Willie a musician.
Well, that's one of my things for which I'm most thankful. That is my emotional outlet today. I used to tell my class occasionally that when I get low here about something in the chemistry department, I go home and play my repertoire of funeral marches. And they'd look at me, what kind of a nuts this? But that's right. No, I get a certain inspiration from playing those funeral. I don't want to play for anybody else. I never do. But I have a good piano.
And after all, it's for your own amazement.
Why, sure. It's my... if I go to a football game, you'll never see me throw my hat in the air at a touchdown. I'm going to lose my hat in the first place. I just don't understand. People sit around me, you see, and get so excited about something or other. I'm not sure what at times. And
what do you think? University life is... or the universities, let me put it this way, are fulfilling their role in society?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know. We're turning out a lot of technicians. We have a lot of unhappy chemists turned loose. And as I've watched this now for 50 years, I have a general opinion, whether it's within the university or it's within industry, but there are all these unhappy people are unhappy because of the fella above them as the handling of humanity. Personnel problems. Most of these are that.
Do you think the world has done, we've done, I don't like to see the world, that we've done reasonably well with the products of chemical graduate work and education? Has chemistry contributed much to our civilization?
Well, we've created lots of new soaps and one thing and another, fine synthetic rubber tires, and all sorts of things. I don't think, I'm very serious about this, that we has contributed one thing. Now, took all science and engineering in this direction. It's contributed one thing toward enabling us to live together. Whenever the computer enthusiasts get loose, I ask them, what's the thing doing to help us live together peaceably, painfully, and so on. No, I'm really greatly disappointed in this.
Well, what about the synthetics? Now, we have more fabrics. In other words, more artifacts and utensils generally for use and comfort.
Oh, yes.
Isn't that chemistry?
Oh, sure.
You're talking about spiritual values.
Yeah. Oh, in terms of things, well, we've created all sorts of things. My best graduate student is a vice president of the great DuPont Company, and under his direction is the entire synthetic textile fiber program. A third of all DuPont is under that man. That I didn't think had ability to manage people when he was my teaching assistant. He offended the students. They didn't like him. But somewhere or other, he's learned to manage people. He's finally reached the vice presidency.
Yes, if he is at DuPont, he's not bad. Is there anything you'd like to say for the tape? We've certainly ranged far and wide. You've given us, in a way, a history of the chemistry department.
Oh, I don't think so. I expected, as I said earlier, to stay, if I could get away, 1 year at Purdue University. This completes my 53rd, and as the years have passed, the famous University of Michigan that I so wanted to go to, I was told by a Michigan professor many years later when I told him this story that I was very lucky I didn't get there at that time, because the head of the department had had an explosion and lost both eyes. For 25 years he was a blind head. It was a very unfortunate period to be there. I would have been there during that period. And as I look on it now, where else would I have been able to achieve what has come to me? I haven't mentioned these, don't like to mention them, but a half a dozen national honors for this work.
Now, you all have, of course, those listed in your vitae.
Spectroscopy and so on.
Yes.
It was sort of a break when E.G. Mahon, you see, was committed academic suicide and left Purdue in 1925. I inherited his job. That's purely a matter of luck. I had nothing to do with it. I just slipped into this position. Had things my own way then. And I would like to say this, as I said in my retirement dinner, that nobody in Purdue University ever told me what to do or what not to do. I never had any pressure to do or not to do things in the Department of Chemistry by that staff or by anybody above in the staff. I've been let alone, so my mistakes are my mistakes.
That speaks well for the university and for your colleagues.
Well, I think, no, I've had really, in that sense, a very fortunate experience. And furthermore, my assigned class, these junior students, they've been weeded four times. They're all chemistry majors, either engineering or science. So they've been weeded four times before I got them as juniors. They were a very choice bunch of students. They're going into this thing professionally, likely all of them. So my troubles with the class were zero. I hear about the freshman staff talking of their troubles. I never had such things. I've had one of the very fortunate appointments in Purdue University.
Years ago, the criticism made of chemistry was that you lost so many people who were majors because you get 1,000 people taking chemistry as freshmen and you only have 50 or 60 majors at the end of it.
Well, nearly all of these people are in the course. We have this great captive audience, you see, of people who have to take freshman chemistry. And I do have this criticism of freshman teaching, and this goes back to President Eliot. He got after us. He was one of these chemically trained presidents. He used to tell us, you're emphasizing too much what he called the minutiae of chemistry, making these students memorize all this little stuff, you see, and paring it back on the next test. I don't believe in that. We've got to relate chemistry to significance of life and so on, in my opinion, to develop their interest. They don't like that. My junior twin grandchildren have just finished up. They're now seniors for next year. And so I listened to them, what they said about our teaching. Well, they're criticizing the same thing that the students were criticizing back in Eliot's day, you see. We're losing our touch because we think this last little equation that somebody developed about something, every freshman must memorize that thing.
In other words, it's like the history teacher that emphasizes the importance of the material contained in his doctor's thesis.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Now, I think there our teaching is not what it could be, because we don't have the student morale that we ought to have. Now, in contrast, the great Kahlenberg at the University of Wisconsin, the freshman teacher up there, who was squeezed out because of what they thought his pro-Germanic background, this back in the days of World War I. Well, I've been told by Wisconsin students, but when that fellow appeared to lecture to his freshman class, the whole class stood up and gave him a Wisconsin Yale. That never happened at Purdue University. Our chemistry teachers, you see, never generated any respect, admiration, or whatever it was that every class, they tell me, his freshman class, they always did that. Well, think of it. Significance of a man's teaching like that. And I understand Snow in physics was the same way up there. Well, those are rare fellows, of course. But I've had a very happy teaching life at Purdue University. And West Lafayette's been a nice, pleasant place to live.
You mentioned grandchildren, and just for the record, how many children have you? And where and when were you married, sir?
Well, I was married the summer following my completion of PhD at Ohio State University.
In other words, you just didn't spend all your time in the laboratory.
No, no. No, I stopped off at the girls' dormitory on the way to the laboratory every night to make these meter readings to get the doctor's thesis completed.
Well, I think that's very important.
So August 30th, 1919, I was married in Cleveland to a then new graduate of Ohio State University. We were married in Cleveland. We took the boat for Detroit. We took the Wabash sleeper for Lafayette, Indiana. That was our wedding trip. Cleveland to Lafayette. I showed up to be a professor at Purdue University. We have one daughter.
How many children have? One daughter?
One daughter.
Grandchildren.
Who's a Purdue graduate.
Yeah.
And she has four children. One of them just was graduated last year in English, to be married July 1st. And the twins, the next ones, are juniors. So next year should complete their work. And then there's a seven-year-younger boy.
Well, that's quite a family. Now, is there something that you'd like to say? Have we...
Family.
Oh, yes, I do note there's a picture of the family on Professor Mellon's desk. Have you anything you'd like to add?
Well, at the moment, I don't think of anything.
All right, we can always come back and have another interview. But until that time, let us say that this is an end of the interview for the Purdue University Archives between Professor M.G. Mellon and Professor Robert Eccles on June 21st, 1972, in room 401B of the Chemistry Building.